name is Karen Blomquist, and this is the introductory session of a whole series this week that can loosely be put under the title Work, Justice, and the Church, or I might have also named that Work, Justice, and the American Dream, because it's the way in which some of our beliefs connected with the American Dream play into some of the crisis of work and unemployment and all the issues connected with that in our own day are some of the kinds of things that we're going to want to do some unpacking and reflecting about during this week. Let me just say in the beginning, I do hope to allow enough time for discussion in each of these sessions, but I think this is a pretty wide ranging kind of topic, so that I would also welcome any of you grabbing me in between sessions and say, hey, you know, I'd like you to hear my version of how I see work and the kinds of factors, the kinds of incidents, the kinds of examples that I'm aware of. So I hope to learn from you, and hopefully you'll learn a little something from me also, but I do see this as a kind of collaborative kind of effort this week. So let me begin, first of all, by putting this in context a bit. First of all, giving you a sense of how I come at this particular topic or series of topics. The position that I have at the seminary at Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago is that of professor of church and society, which means one of my primary kinds of challenges is to continually try to think through how the church relates to society. John, this morning in the lecture, indicated some of the ways in which the church has related to society or relates to society in our own day. But I'm especially the person on the faculty who's trying to continually say, okay, how do we understand better what's going on out there? In a sense, I'm doing the other side of that twofold kind of thing that John Schramm was raising up this morning. If we think of Jesus as the norm in relationship to the reality, my focus is especially trying to unpack and understand, okay, what is that reality? What are those societal kinds of factors that we need to understand and analyze more deeply than we as the church sometimes have? So that's my particular kind of focus. During the 8 years or so that I was a pastor of a local congregation, one of the aspects of that whole relationship between church and society that came to the fore again and again, or one of the real gaps that I became very aware of, was the gap between much of what we talk about in the church, especially on Sunday morning, and what, in fact, people's lives are like the rest of the week, namely the Monday through Friday kinds of realities, what's often been called the gap between Sunday morning and Monday morning. And I think a lot of the times, the language of the church, whenever it's tried to address the world of work, has done so in some fairly idealistic kinds of ways. So we say, oh, well, you serve God by doing whatever you do in your daily life. Well, in some occupations, that's easy to do. In others, particularly the occupations of my mostly working class parishioners, that was a little harder to talk about. You know, how am I serving God by putting on this bolt or by doing this or that or by cleaning somebody's bathroom? Well, yeah, there may be some servant imagery and some of that. But nevertheless, people were often very hard-pressed to talk about how all of the serving God by what you do in your daily life kind of stuff really connected with what, in fact, they were doing. A year or two before I finished my pastorate in Brooklyn, New York, I did a little, very unscientific survey with some of my parishioners. And it was a very simple kind of questionnaire, asking them about their jobs and what they did and what they liked about their jobs and this sort of thing. And perhaps the most telling response was that of a retired railroad worker who responded this way to the questionnaire. When the questionnaire asked what he liked about his work, he said, nothing. When I asked him what did he do, he said, well, it was work. when I asked him how he felt when he left work, he responded, "Better." And the final question, they were to complete the statement, "I envy people who have jobs blank." He responded that he envied people who have jobs they like. Now, I'm not saying that that is necessarily typical of the majority of the population. It perhaps was a bit more honest than some of the people in my congregation. But it I think, points to the core of the strange kind of irony that we enter into when we talk about work or think about work. Namely, that work is something that is both craved and cursed. It's certainly something that people crave when they don't have it, and yet in the midst of jobs, even in jobs that might from the outside look somewhat fulfilling and meaningful, there's some amount of cursing that goes on about those jobs, even though that perhaps is the kind of cursing that the pastor often does not hear. Another part of how I come at my interest in this particular topic is out of a long history of some real commitment to various concerns of justice. And I've become increasingly aware through the years of how when I entered my first congregation as pastor back in 74 with the kinds of social justice commitments that I brought to it, the approach I often used was often kind of a hit 'em over the head kind of approach. I really wasn't quite that bad, but I now realize that it was often a matter of trying to call people to be concerned about all kinds of social justice concerns out there, apart from their lives. Be concerned about the blacks and the Hispanics, although both of those populations were very close, seeing both of my congregations were in changing communities. But rather than taking seriously some of the very real issues of justice that impinged quite directly upon the lives of my mostly middle American parishioners, I think a lot of times here at Holden or elsewhere we can say, oh well, yeah, there's all those justice kinds of concerns there, but what about where I live my life and the kinds of issues of exploitation and oppression or injustice that I experience and that are often not named that way because, those other concerns indeed are greater concerns of injustice, perhaps, than the examples of injustice that we experience. And yet I think we need to be far more sensitive than we have in terms of naming and helping folks that we relate to unpack the nature of some of the kinds of injustice that they experience in their own lives. And I think that's especially true in the present era, which I would say is an era of profound social and economic changes, where there are some enormous changes going on in terms of the world of work, in terms of the structuring of work, and where a lot of folks are getting caught in between those changes and not knowing quite what to do about it, seeing that we all live in a society where we're told that, well, if only you try hard enough, you too can make it. And somehow, if you don't make it, there must be something wrong with you. And it's that, I think, extraordinarily pathetic kind of situation, that being caught between the message, the predominant message in American society, a message of individualism and of effortocracy, you too can make it if only you try hard enough, and the reality of people's lives, that we're really going to want to look at, and especially tomorrow where I want to do some real unpacking of that ideology and how I think it really is a spiritual, theological kind of crisis that needs to be understood in relationship to that American dream kind of message that people have been conditioned to live their lives according to. I think that crisis is something that is impacting not just folks who are involved in certain basic industries in the South Chicago area near where I live, especially the industry of steel and the incredible cutbacks in that industry. But I think also a number of other labor market arenas of our economy, and certainly the farm area and the farm crisis, the kind of connections between what's happening to people in urban areas and what's happening to people in rural areas, and the kind of the sense of helplessness that so many people are feeling in the midst of all of that. Let me just share with you some of the litany of the signs of our time that indicate that something is not quite right, or that some things are changing and we don't quite know what kind of sense to make out of all of that. Towns, families, and individuals who have worked hard to make it are devastated by the closing of factories in industries that have been the backbone of our economy. More persons are now employed in low-paying McDonald's fast food jobs than are employed by the entire American basic steel industry. We've all heard and seen the accounts on TV of the hardworking farmers who are in danger of having their family farms foreclosed. Two, 3 weeks ago, I was in Nebraska and heard the manager of a grain elevator talk about the continual refrain of children who are really, you know, who are running the farm and trying to make a go of it, and who hear from their parents, well, you know, we made it through the 30s, why can't you make it through the 80s? Youth wondering what use it is to continue on in school. The vast, amorphous middle class shrinking rather than growing as more and more people experience downward mobility, which again goes against the promise that, you know, if you work hard, you'll achieve upward mobility. The media exploits the image of those few who are succeeding, the so-called yuppies, who actually are a rather small percentage of that 20 to 40-year-old baby boomer generation. Recent statistics that I've seen indicate that over half of this so-called baby boomer generation, over half are either unemployed or earn less than $10,000 a year. So that the media image of, you know, the yuppies who have to drive the Mercedes, et cetera, is indeed an image that is characteristic of a fairly small percentage of the 20 to 40-year-old generation. And some recent statistics have also indicated that even though there may be some economic growth occurring, 70% of that economic growth is now occurring on the Eastern Seaboard and in California, while the rest of us in Middle America become increasingly poorer. Those, I think, are some of the signs of the times that would indicate, hey, we need to look again at what's going on and try to understand that and to say, hey, why is that? And, you know, and how do we deal with the resultant pain in the middle of that? One of the things I try to do on my faculty is to try to counterbalance what some of the people who teach in the area of pastoral care tend to emphasize. You know, a lot of what pastors are equipped to do when they go through seminary is to try to deal pastorally with the pains of people, with, you know, the marriages that are falling apart, the problems of alcoholism, the various kinds of counseling kinds of situations. A number of people lately are saying, hey, yeah, that needs to be done. But we as the church also need to dig a little deeper and to say, okay, we need to deal with the symptoms, but let's also look at some of the causal factors of that. Let's look at how what's happening in the workplace, in a lot of cases, results in some of the stress-related problems of alcoholism, drugs, marital breakups, etc. And therefore, we need to look at what's happening in the wider society if, in fact, we as the church are going to be more effective in addressing those immediate kinds of pressures and problems and crises that, that people are undergoing. And so that's one of my biases of plunging into some of those very real pains of people, which has historically been the kind of pastoral calling of the church. But to realize that as we plunge deeply into the pain that is besetting people today, that inevitably pulls us into a prophetic asking of why is it that way? I don't think there's this disjuncture between the prophetic and the pastoral, but I think the prophetic grows organically out of that pastoral yearning to be in touch with the pains that people are feeling. And so that continual asking of why, and therefore looking at some of the structural factors that have resulted in some of the kinds of problems that the people are struggling and contending with, I think is a very key and important kind of challenge of the church in the day. It's really the challenge of the church that moves the church from what has tended to be a preoccupation with the private concerns of life, with concerns that impinge upon the home and the family, and is a calling of the church to pay much more attention to some of the public realities, some of the realities of work and of the political order, and how some of those forces out there impinge upon and affect some of the very private kinds of concerns of people. Now, let me just shift gears a bit and say something about why I think this focus is an especially appropriate one for us to think about here at Holden. Now, on the surface, some of you probably said, you know, looked at that and said, well, there's nothing else going on at four, so I'll come and see what this Bloomquist character has to say. But heavens, you know, this is vacation, and I really don't want to talk about work. You know, that's what I left behind. And, you know, oh, come on now, let's not get back into that. I think it's important. It's an interesting kind of thing for us to reflect a bit about work at a place like Holden, because I think Holden epitomizes one of those rare places around where there is an embodiment of a much different kind of meaning of work from the predominant kind of meaning of work that people experience in the wider world. Namely, work that is not alienated or so hierarchically organized in a way that people feel dominated and unfulfilled and, you know, work as a curse, but work as a much more participatory kind of an egalitarian kind of endeavor. It's the kind of place where teaching staff like myself on the first day we're here end up on the dirty dish team. And there's something very positive about that as an important kind of model. You know, it's not a matter of, well, these are the elite up here and these are the, you know, the cleaner uppers on the bottom of the pyramid. And I think what's been unique and I think what has been meaningful in the past for me about what Holden embodies is a very holistic and much different notion of what work might be. And I think we need that kind of expression of work, what work can be, because the predominant expressions in our society are something quite different. I think it's also important that we reflect on work and what's happening to the structuring of work in our society, and to do that beneath the shadow of a deserted and deteriorating Holden mine, which in a strange kind of way is an ominous symbol of an industry deserted when it was no longer profitable to mine here. Now, John Schramm was reminding me yesterday, you know, this was according to prediction. You know, the assayers or whoever makes the prediction to decide whether it was going to be worthwhile to mine all the stuff around us indicated, yeah, maybe 20 years of mining is what there would be in these mountains, and in fact that was about the lifespan of the mining operation that occurred here. But the first day I was here, it was very interesting to look up in the mine at some of the headlines of the newspapers from the Wenatchee paper in 1939, headlines that were celebrating how the mine would end joblessness in this part of Washington, and celebrating the good work conditions, and really seeing the mine as a real panacea and a real breakthrough in terms of the kinds of jobs that would make possible in this part of Washington. Now, even though some of the conditions and some of the factors are different, and I don't want to quickly equate those, nevertheless, seeing that mine on the first day that I was back here reminded me of what may be an all too increasing sight across our national landscape in years to come, and is already occurring as more and more basic industries close their doors, especially in industries like steel, which is one of them that I'm more familiar with, seeing it's close to where I live. Industries that are closing, not necessarily because they're no longer making a profit, but because they are not seen as being profitable enough. And therefore, major industries that are much more turning to means of making profit that involve all kinds of mergers rather than increasing productive capacity or continuing to run this factory or this industry. Two of the economists who I think have been very insightful in terms of understanding deindustrialization, Bluestone and Harrison, talk about how capital mobility, namely capital moving to ever cheaper labor markets, has become the strategy for corporate profitability in our day. So a few years ago, it was a matter of many companies moving to the southern part of the United States, where they didn't have to contend so much with unions and all the rest. Well, Houston and some other areas are now experiencing some devastation also, and you know, they're no longer going south, they're going to third world labor markets where labor continues to be far cheaper. That capital mobility kind of scheme is certainly one in which job security for even the most loyal workers is jeopardized. And so again, this kind of betrayal of the American dream, where people who have spent 20, 30 years as loyal workers for certain companies, all of a sudden, just before they reach retirement age, find themselves out of work. And not because they didn't do a good job, but for some other mysterious and hidden factors that for the most part, people find it difficult to understand. Now, I think it's crucial that more and more people and more secular analysts of what's going on in terms of the workplace are concluding that communities of faith, the church, the synagogue, etc., communities of faith who live by an alternative vision are, if anything, the last hope to begin to raise some questions and to challenge some of those patterns of reorganization of work, some of those changes that are going on in our society. That the church is a community of faith that is key in challenging the endless proliferation of deserted factories and farms and the linked devastation of communities and of families and of individuals. And that the church is perhaps the sole community that can bring up the necessity of having some kind of moral accountability between the whole matter of bottom line as the only base of accountability. Now that doesn't, you know, I'm not naively saying that, well, somehow we can throw off that whole bottom line kind of criteria. You know, I think we can't ignore that, yeah, that's part of what we're dealing with. That's part of the reality that we're dealing with. But at the same time, a number of coalitions and groups and organizing efforts around the country of particularly church people in coalition with others, are beginning to raise some basic questions about that monopoly of bottom line thinking as the sole criteria as to what happens in terms of not just the workplace, but in terms of the communities and the families and the persons and the people who are dependent on those. Let me just pause for a moment and see if there's some questions of clarification. I want to go on and say something about the kinds of biblical kinds of understandings of work that I think we need to juxtapose with what's going on in our own day. But let me just see if there's some...
I have just a question, but I know you're probably doing this, but this also puts the church in conflict as to how to confront what's happening vis-a-vis the Pennsylvania situation. Pastors have gotten involved in direct confrontation, and the church gets involved, and there's discipline and chaos and confusion.
That's right. Well, yes, and I would say, and we may want to talk more about that.
Because that's a fascinating case.
Yeah, and I think it is a very instructive case, because no matter how critical we might want to be about DMS, and I have my own critique to raise about it too, nevertheless, they tried to do something, and in a sense exposes the fact that how ill-equipped we as the church are when it comes to addressing some of these public issues.
And then to the leadership of the church and the failure of leadership to really deal with that creatively. Yeah. I mean, I saw that. But,
and that's why I think we need forums like the one that we will hopefully have this week to really process that too, because I don't think there are simple answers or simple strategies, but we need to somehow really do some grappling with that, and in order to come at some criteria, some norms, how do we move ahead in that?
Something that's always puzzled me is that naturally living in the United States, it's great, it's grand, it's glorious. There are all these third world countries. My wife and I, we travel quite a bit. We see them all, and that seems like the Pope comes on a little visit and saying things are going to get better. Big American companies, for some strange reason, are going to, all the jobs move south or whichever way, where there's a lot of cheap labor market. It seems like the will of the Lord seems to be that these people should have a little something more, but why should the American people have to pay the expense for it? I mean, it seems like that's the ultimate thing, the way it works out. Their lives are being lifted up a little bit, even so they do have a job. And we, in the free world, seem like we're losing it.
Yeah, I think...
puzzling, like the way that God works in mysterious ways. If this is his will, I guess, it works out so he can't even find words to express it.
Although the interesting thing in the midst of that is I think sometimes we have... sat back at times and said, well, it's God's will, without realizing some of the very real human decisions that have been gone into that. And I think, but without, I want to get into that kind of issue later on this week, because I think one of the things that I want to begin to find some connections between is, what's happening to workers in this country and what's happening to workers in the third world. Yeah, many of them have jobs, but there's real exploitation of their labor too. And therefore, there's a sense in which what U.S. workers are experiencing and what they then blame on, the third world, there's some similar causal factors that are exploiting laborers there as well as exploiting laborers here. And I think there's a commonality there rather than being pit against one another that it needs to be developed far more than normally has in terms of the kind of popular kind
well,
of
listen.
That's something I think we'll want to come back to. Anything else at this point that you're eager to get in?
Along the same line, the church that's in Bangor, Washington, where the Lutheran church that's found where all the people are worked on missiles, and how does the church deal with peace issues when that sort of thing? The issues of the day will serve that community that builds the weapons.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Or the whole, I've recently been asked to speak at a National Council of Churches gathering this in December that's dealing with the theme of eco-justice, you know, economic justice and environmental justice. You know, and there's a lot of tensions there where, as I think you're rightly pointing out, the simplistic answers say, well, it's all this way and that way. You know, it's not quite that simple. And how do we then work through that? You know, rather than saying, well, one is all evil and one isn't, you know, what does it mean to recognize how we are caught up in some, well, I would want to say in some sinful structures, but that doesn't mean that some of us come off totally clean and some of us are all evil. You know, somehow we're all caught up in that together, which means we need to struggle through together. One of the efforts I was involved in, not recently, but in the beginning stages, was a group in the Great Lakes and Appalachian area, an ecumenical coalition on the economic crisis, which now has moved to the point of working towards some very concrete advocacy issues in the various states in that region, dealing with plant closings and all the rest, not presuming that they're going to stem the tide of all of that, but at least finding some ways to bring some component of moral responsibility into those decisions as to what happens and how it happens and how people are affected by it. So I think there's an incredible amount of power that working collaboratively, not just with other churches, but also with some other groups, with some unions, with some community organizing, you know, with a number of other groups that are raising some similar kinds of concerns. So that's another kind of thing. Okay, let me move on, because I realize the time is moving along. And just remind us of some biblical perspectives on the whole matter of work. Work is seen from a biblical perspective, and here I'm especially thinking of the perspective that comes through in Genesis 2. Work is seen as expressive of who and whose we are. It is seen as that which sustains us, not because of the end product or the income it produces. You know, not work in order to make a living, but work itself intrinsically being that which sustains us, gives our lives meaning, fulfillment, and purpose. Work as an activity that is basic to who we as human beings are. Namely, we are co-creators with God and with one another. The LCA statement on economic justice talks about how through work we reflect the Creator whose work we are. And our working is it's our species' way of being and of becoming. We transform the world, and in so doing, we transform ourselves. It is something that occurs in community. It sets us in relationship to one another. It is meaningful in and of itself. And so we find in verse 15 of Genesis 2 that we are placed in God's garden to work and preserve it. Note, we are not made for the purpose of working God's garden. The garden is made for our benefit, for our enjoyment, not for our labor. But we work in it as part of our shalom-like relationship with God and with one another. And there is gain for us in so doing, but not in the tangible, usually monetary ways that we think of gains in working today. The gains are much more the intrinsic satisfaction. That's where the human benefit of work is seen as being located. So, as the LCA statement goes on to say, it's not that persons are meant for work, but work is meant for persons in community. And I think all too often we've switched that formula around so that, you know, the end of human beings is to work rather than work as a means of fulfilling persons in community. So there's a strain within the biblical witness of that notion of work as that into which we pour ourselves, so that the product of our labor expresses who we are. And having a 3.5-year-old son is perhaps one of the prime ways of discovering that, how Aaron will just pour himself into what he's doing. And, you know, the result of his labor, that's not really important, but he can stand up on top of the climbing equipment behind Narnia and turn that steering wheel, and the fact that the car isn't going anywhere, that doesn't matter, but there's the intrinsic fulfillment in just standing there and turning the wheel. Now, that whole understanding of work, I would imagine for most people in American society, sounds extraordinarily elitist. It's an understanding of work that might be true for, you know, a few folks like seminary professors or people who live for a year or longer at Holden Village, or a few others who can do what they really enjoy doing, including many who are retired or who are self-employed or who have gone back to the land or have begun certain small cottage industries. But it doesn't sound like a very realistic possibility for most in our society, for most who find themselves pervasively shaped by the realities of late industrial capitalism, which tends to generate and result in a somewhat truncated understanding of work, namely seeing work as that which is measurable in GNP terms, that which can be measured in dollar and cents terms. And if it doesn't have a very big dollar sign value on it, well, then it just ain't worth very much. And that, you see, is a very truncated view of what work is, because what I was just saying a moment ago is that the biblical that early biblical understanding of work includes the whole spectrum of activity that is basic to life itself. A much wider expanse of what is work than that very narrow kind of notion of work that is what we tend to think of when we think of the labor market and what people do. In this truncated view, we are what we do measured in terms of the financial benefit. And without that dollar sign, work is not valued very highly. Be that work the work of parenting, of homemaking, be that the volunteer civic activities, or all the other forms of work that contribute in some very crucial ways to the life of the community. Hannah Arendt is a philosopher that some of you may be familiar with, who made the very basic distinction, which is a distinction I'm drawing on here, between the work of the hands, this fulfilling work, sense of work, versus the labor of the body. The latter is a kind of work which serves simply to put bread into the laborer's mouth through certain repetitive motions. Kind of work as curse kind of notion. Now this second view, which hints at something of work's alienating character, or the work itself having little inherent value other than what it makes possible, namely the paycheck that one can bring home, that has often been traced back to another biblical understanding of work or of labor, which goes back to the account in the third chapter of Genesis. The Genesis 3 understanding of, quote, in toil you shall eat of the ground all the days of your life, unquote. Now, that's an understanding of work that emerges after the fall. And I think we need to remember that, because that means that understanding of work or of labor is expressive not of the divine intent, but is expressive instead of our broken relationship with God. And the interesting thing that's too often occurred in the life of the church is that we have made that normative of what work is. In other words, we've made the sinful context of that meaning of work normative, as if that's the way that work is intended to be. And so then, you know, we all lapse into the tendency to think of work as the proverbial pain in the neck, the kind of grin and bear it connotation of work, such that life's real meaning and value end up being found apart from one's work. And that has certainly been a development that has occurred since the time of industrialization, although not some of it prior to that also, but especially with the onset of industrialization and the whole separation between work and family. What happens then when we have this second view of work that is alienated rather than fulfilling in and of itself, is that the self is denied rather than affirmed through human productive activity. And the products of human labor become a world unto themselves. And then suddenly workers are struck with how the machine or how making a profit comes to feel more important than the human beings themselves. The means of production end up employing the worker, or in our day, at times threatening to unemploy the worker, rather than human beings seeing themselves as active agents of their world, which is what that original biblical intent is all about. And this then, in turn, results in our feeling of being alienated from one another. We see one another not as our brothers and sisters, but instead as those who are in competition with us for those jobs, or as those who exercise control over us, the boss over the workers, or those who just might take our jobs from us if we don't watch out. Now, I won't have that much time to unpack this today, but I think we need then to look at what's happened to work and to raise some very specifically theological, some deeply theological questions in the face of that. For example, how adequate is our usual Lutheran doctrine of vocation in the face of that? Basically, Luther suggested that we live out our God-given calling in our daily work, whatever that might be. And his intent was to say, you know, it's not just in religious vocations. It's not just by being a priest or a nun, but in secular jobs, we also live out our calling. Now, I think there's something important in that that I don't want to throw out, but I think I'm not sure that that's the most helpful theological kind of resource for us to begin to draw on as we begin to make some theological sense of all of this. Certainly, those of you who aren't Lutheran but who've been maybe influenced by some of the Calvinist tradition have, if anything, an even tougher kind of road on this score, because the Calvinists intensified this understanding of vocation and saw work as a religious duty and not working as sinful. And certainly that's the view of work that has especially undergirded our whole Protestant work ethic that has so deeply influenced American society, and that I think becomes an incredibly painful kind of backdrop for people who then find themselves out of work and, you know, have that deep ingrained sense of, you know, this is my religious duty, and all of a sudden, hey, you know, now I'm a failure, not just a failure in relationship to the community, but I'm a failure before God too, because I'm not fulfilling my religious duty. You know, and even though one might be able to rationally explain, well, it's this factor and that factor that's generated that, it has a very deep, irrational kind of pull on a lot of people. And so I've talked with pastors who are especially trying to deal with farmers who've lost their farms and who you know, that is so deeply ingrained that, you know, just telling them that hey, you know, that's not how you're judged, that in and of itself doesn't quite get through. So what becomes a more helpful thing, and I'll be doing some more unpacking of this as we move through the week, is to unpack some of the understandings in our tradition of what sin has been understood as being. Not sin as individual acts of wrongdoing, but sin as that which comes to feel as a kind of power of domination that rules over us and that results in certain structuring of work according to, you know, the bottom line criteria and all the rest, and that catches us all up and makes us feel very passive in the face of that, so that the upper level managers feel, well, you know, there's not much I can do either. You know, I've got to do this because if I don't, then, you know, my competitor over here is going to do it instead. And so all of us end up feeling very passive, and the powerlessness feeds onto one another. And I think that feeling is one of the primary manifestations of sin in our day. Not sin as what I've done wrong, but sin as that kind of controlling power that rules over me and makes me then feel that, well, that's the way it is. You've got to go along with it. And you just don't worry, you don't bother to question all of that. Now, I think that way in which the way things are and the inevitability of the way things are rules over us really needs to be challenged from out of the heart of what a stance of faith might mean. One of the people who have influenced me a lot in this, and I see some of you who I know have done some reading of hers, is Dorothy Zola, whose book To Work and to Love is, I think, in the bookstore, and who was the person under whom I did a lot of my doctoral work when I was at Union Seminary in New York. And one of the phrases that she has that I think is what really empowers me to say, hey, does it have to be this way, is her understanding that faith is the struggle against objective cynicism. Faith is that refusal to just sit back and say, well, that's the way it is, and, you know, we've got to accept that that's how corporate power operates in this country. But faith is that refusal to simply succumb, that refusal to remain passive and seemingly powerless in the face of all of this. Faith is something that occurs as we together stand as a community of faith that refuses to let the domination of sin have the last word, but realizes that as that community of faith, we've been captured by God's grace, and therefore we are oriented toward the promise of God's kingdom, rather than being in captivity only to, you know, the way things are and the inevitability of certain restructuring of the work world, certain patterns of restructuring the work world that are going on in our day. And I think it is when we begin to all of a sudden make that shift that we can begin to discover that there are some God-given resources to begin to make an alternative vision and an alternative set of values real in our world. Yes, even real in the midst of our economic life. And suddenly we begin to uncover a new Jesus' own model of work that is non-competitive and interdependent, with success measured in terms of what is just for the community and for its future, rather than measured only in terms of individual achievement or status or the making it that merely serves the needs of the present. Now, as I think John also hinted at this morning, the difficulty is that we look around, and in a lot of our churches, some of the most competitive, some of the most punitive, if you're not working, kinds of dynamics can go on in a conscious, if not unconscious, way even there. My own my own work has especially been focused on certain working class realities, and I'm very aware of how some of the patterns of class in American society get replicated, if not reinforced or legitimized, in churches. But I think at the same time we have to say, hey, can our communities of faith embody something else so that they can be places of support in the midst of the kind of crisis of work that people are finding themselves in? Well, as I thought I might do, I kind of went on, but let me just stop here and get some of your responses, questions, some other dimensions of this whole problem that you are acutely aware of, either in terms of your own experience or the experience of those that you know of.
You're talking about the feeling of guilt a lot of people have because they work ethic that they hold it in. We're seeing a lot of this too. Leads to suicide. We've seen a lot of that happen in the Valley of California.
I have some statistics that I may share with you next day or so, but indicating there's somebody in the Department of Labor a few years ago did a study indicating that a 1% increase in unemployment results in a 4% increase in suicides, 6% increase in prison population, incredible increase in alcoholism, drug use, child abuse, all kinds of problems, which, you know, again indicates, yeah, those problems, those symptoms need to be treated. But are we, as the church, being responsible if we only treat those tips of the iceberg? Or do we need to look much more deeply at those other kind, you know, precipitating kinds of problems? So yeah, that's all related, and I think makes the problem even more severe in terms of many manifestations it can have. Other comments, questions? I know this is not a very hopeful kind of note to end the first session on, although I did try to want to make that pitch about what I think the stance of faith mean in the midst of this, because I think it is that which does give us some hope and makes the church somewhat unique in terms of an institution and society where something else can be offered up than just the same old thing of going along with the seeming inevitability of what's going on in our society.
I'm looking forward to looking up some models of that. Give us the kind of courage to launch out, to develop the kind of community and the kind of support system you're talking about. The work is not determined in the way you describe or define the society, define support, define the way the church begins to mirror that. And I think I agree that the church could be, really could be,
yeah, and I guess what really strikes me is the number of secular voices that are pointing to the religious community. You know, which it's really kind of startling to see how many are saying, "Hey, you know, we don't know how we're going to change this, but the church somehow has a voice and a biblical kind of resource that suggests something quite different."
What are some examples of the secular voice?
A book I've recently read, which I would recommend to all of you, is a book that is published by an outfit called the Institute for Labor and Mental Health, located in Oakland, California. And the director of that, a man by the name of Michael Lerner, is a psychotherapist and has been a social activist for a number of years. He's written a book called Surplus Powerlessness. And he charts out all the many ways in which people are made to feel more powerless than they in fact are. And he begins by saying, yeah, there is a sense in which people aren't, you know, there is a genuine sense of powerlessness. But how a sense of powerlessness and apathy feeds onto itself. And he's writing this as a, I guess, a fairly secularized kind of Jew. But after he's unpacked this for chapter after chapter, he says, hey, you know, especially the prophetic dynamic within religious community is the key to that turning around.